Good afternoon, all. It's great to be here after such a long time doing virtual conferences. And thanks, Steve, for the opportunity to moderate and also such an esteemed panel today. So without further ado, I'll take the opportunity to just introduce the panel, starting on, I think, the farthest from me, a veteran in this area, some might say a pioneer, so Michael Bennett, Head of Derivatives and Structured Finance, joining us all the way from Washington. And then Scott McCarty, whom I think was up here earlier, so needs no introduction. So he's, and for those who missed this morning session, he's the Head of Risk Finance of Tokatu Ake, that I believe is rising up from a strong foundation, and he can describe that in more detail later. And then next to me, Esther, who's joining us from Swiss Re with a special focus as Senior Product Manager on all things sovereign risk transfer related in the region. So let's just get straight into it. I think a lot has been said about public sector solutions today, from CDRIF to PACRIF, lots of acronyms thrown around. And also, you know, that Totara cat bond has received a lot of attention. So hopefully, you know, not too much of our talk has been usurped by the others, and we can get into a more high-level, broader discussion around policy, sovereign risk sort of attitudes, and take a slightly different take in this panel, all right? So starting with you, Michael, since you've been at the sort of infancy of this sort of growth of this sector, can you provide a bit of an overview of growth and trends in the public sector risk transfer over the past few decades, please?
Well, a few decades, okay. I don't know if I can go that far back, but I can tell you a little bit about what we've been doing at the World Bank and how it's developed. We were looking at this from a point of view of insurance markets generally being very valuable to our client countries. And if you don't know the World Bank, we are a membership organization with 189 members that are all sovereign governments, and they're also our shareholders, and they're the entities that we provide various forms of financial assistance to. So we saw that insurance could be a very valuable addition to their toolkit for financial resilience, particularly obviously for countries that are heavily vulnerable to natural disasters, but that it was very difficult for countries to access insurance for various reasons. Certainly the cat bond market, very difficult for sovereign countries often to understand. Even general purchasing insurance or reinsurance can be difficult for countries for issues like procurement. Some countries we work with, just to pick a broker could be a one-year procurement process and always subject to second guessing as well. So very difficult. So we wanted to make it easier, even though at the World Bank we have no mandate to take on any insurance risk. So we can't sit on or warehouse any risk, but we wanted to make it easier. So what we do at the World Bank is we provide an insurance policy to a member government. In almost every case, a parametric insurance policy, and we can talk later if it comes up why that is, but almost always a parametric insurance policy. Against specified risks or risks. And as I said, we can't warehouse that risk. We can't sit on that risk. So what we need to do when we provide that insurance policy is immediately turn around and hedge ourselves, either by issuing a catastrophe bond, which we've done more often than not, or by ourselves purchasing reinsurance to reinsure ourselves against the risk we just took on by writing that insurance policy. So that's the basic business we came up with to make it very easy for governments to access insurance and reinsurance, because now they have only one counterparty. We're their insurance company, and we're a AAA insurance company, and not only that, they sit on our board of directors. So if they ever have a problem with their insurance company, they can complain through their Ministry of Finance that the World Bank isn't doing a good enough job insuring them. So very powerful, and I would say best in class for most sovereign governments to have us as their insurer. And facing the market on their behalf or in partnership with them. So we started to do that as a transaction level in 2009. We used to have something we called the MultiCat program that Mexico used a couple of times. MultiCat program still involved us setting up an SPV, which created its own issues for some governments. They don't like necessarily to work through Cayman Islands or other tax, I don't know what the nice word for those are, tax neutral,
tax efficient.
Other tax efficient jurisdictions, so still was a problem. So in 2014, we decided let's get rid of the SPV and let's issue these things in our own name. That took some changes of our bond program. We had to create a supplement to our bond program that allowed us to issue things that may not be rated AAA because these cat bonds are not wouldn't be entitled to a AAA rating. But once we did that, that really set off that was 2014, set off a big course of new cat bond issuance for us. So the first deal we did in our own name was for the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility, CRIF, which I think was mentioned this morning. We then did some deals for Mexico. We did a famous pandemic transaction that covered six viruses. One was a little-known virus called coronavirus, which ended up meaning the transaction triggered in early 2019. For our biggest payout on any of these transactions we've done, it was about a $200 million payout from the pandemic transaction. We did a very interesting transaction, first of its kind, where four countries came together at one time. They were not literally in the same bond. It was actually multiple tranches of bonds, but we packaged them together, called the Pacific Alliance cat bond transaction. That covered earthquakes in Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru, all done at the same time for a total of about $1.3 billion, which shows how strong the market was. At that time, I believe that was a 2018 transaction. Very, very, very liquid market at that time, and we were able to do $1.3 billion transaction all in the same day. And we have continued to do more transactions. We brought Jamaica, our first Caribbean country, by itself to the market. We brought the Philippines to the market. I'm not sure it was on the APAC list, but we brought the Philippines to the market, and that was also the first cat bond ever listed in Singapore. More recently, we did the first cat bond ever listed in Hong Kong, which was for Chile. So we see a lot more activity. In terms of trends for the future, I would say for us, it's very much more of the same. We have a lot of countries that are vulnerable, and so we will continue to see us doing earthquake, doing hurricane, possibly looking at new risk for pandemic, but that's our history.
Thanks, Michael. You were mentioning there's, 189 member states?
That's right.
If I recall correctly. No, that's really impressive and really good runs on the board there. Moving to you, Scott, much has been said and lauded about the Totara Re transaction, so we'll maybe go before that. You mentioned that the first reinsurance contract, in fact, for the EQC, then named the EQC, actually started in 1988. You maybe take us through a little bit of the journey to the past,
yeah,
and then how you've come to arrive at today.
Yeah, I think actually understanding your kind of history is actually quite important for thinking about your kind of options for the future, and particularly as we think about protection gaps, because where we've ended up today is a product of nearly 80 years of history. So, we came into existence on the 1st of January 1944. Following a series of really significant earthquakes in New Zealand over a period of about 13 or 14 years before that. For anyone who's invested in the bond, we did fully disclose that as part of the investor presentations. But it was a point where there was no natural hazard insurance in New Zealand, and so you had this really, really slow recovery from two fairly substantial earthquakes in 1942. So the government set about putting in place a natural hazard insurance scheme, which focused entirely on earthquake. It was just earthquake, but they did some kind of interesting things, which from a kind of a behavioural economics perspective seem incredibly kind of far-sighted, in the sense that they said, right, well, we're just going to attach the earthquake policy to a fire policy. It was the most common residential and commercial policy going around. So if you had a fire policy for a commercial building or a residential building, you got natural hazard insurance as well. And at the time, it was war damages as well, so Earthquake and War Damages Committee. Fast forward, better part of 40 years, had very few earthquakes over that period of time. All of a sudden, we went very quiet from a geological sense, which I'm certainly very hopeful that we'll get back to at some point soon in New Zealand. It would be handy. But we had a couple of earthquakes where the biggest exposure to the Crown was from its, because it covered commercial assets. So it made a decision in 1993 to get out of commercial. So those were ceded completely back to the private. And so from 1993, we've focused purely on residential, and other perils have been added in response to different claims. So we cover landslip in New Zealand, because in 1979, an entire hillside in Dunedin that had 60 houses sitting perfectly atop it ended up in the Green Island Rugby Football Club rooms in Dunedin. So Abbotsford was the trigger for land cover to be added to our perils. So, you know, the kind of perils that you, from a policy perspective, you kind of end up as a product of a whole range of kind of historical decisions. And one of which was, as you mentioned, was in 1988, we placed our first reinsurance contract in the Lloyd's market. And that was really, again, reflecting the growing understanding of the liability that we faced, and thinking about not just our ability as a single Crown entity to finance that, but actually the type of protection that we were actually providing for the Crown balance sheet. So that kind of growing realisation, and I guess the process that we undertake now, a very close consultation with our Ministry of Finance, thinking about the protection that we're providing, not just for claimants to our scheme. I mean, our core goal, our purpose for being, is to reduce the impact of natural disasters on people and property. And we do that in a range of ways, from not only risk transfer, but a substantial chunk of our money every year is invested in research to try and understand the hazards, try and influence building standards, think about the kind of, you know, the full risk transfer profile. But ultimately, when we think about our risk transfer, it is about how do we protect the Crown's balance sheet. So I think when we talk about protection gap entities, you have to think about these as evolving over time and having kind of government will and flexibility to change those settings as you move forward, and for providers of capital solutions and policy solutions to recognise that as well, because a product that works well for us, and I think the Totara Re transaction works incredibly well for us. Traditional reinsurance has worked incredibly well for us. It was tested strongly through the Canterbury earthquakes, has proved to be resilient, from a claims perspective and from a relationship perspective, and we've been able to continue to participate in that market. But I think it is quite important to, when you're thinking about protection gap entities, to be really clear about the kind of specific political, cultural and societal kind of things about what is it you're actually trying to protect, and how do the solutions that you have as capital and other providers really fit into that, so that there is actually a really workable solution to that, or a good fit.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. And I think there are many, many good learnings to be had there on that journey, also by other sort of market participants, potentially in the APAC region. And also very interesting that, you know, ultimately you're trying to protect the Crown's balance sheet. So, you know, you're going sort of maybe a little bit of a different route to risk-based pricing, where you're charging, you know, a standard sort of rate for every single fire policy. And so that's quite interesting. So onto the protection gap, it is a huge issue, particularly in the developing world, particularly with the advent of climate change and, you know, more recently social inflation concerns as well, and not forgetting, you know, the geophysical stuff like earthquakes. Just to quote some numbers that I got from Artemis, actually, on the Turkey earthquake, the tragic Turkey earthquakes earlier this year. So out of potentially over 100 billion of economic loss, only 4 to 5 billion was insured. And out of that 4 to 5 billion, only 300 million actually came from, you know, sort of sovereign risk transfer type mechanisms. So there's a huge gap. That's all the point I wanted to make. So over to you now, Esther. In your line of work, what do you think are the key challenges preventing a greater take-up of public sector solutions?
Yes, I would say that the key challenges we see is kind of education side from the public sector. There's lack of risk awareness and also lack of value of transfer risk transfer itself. And especially for the public sector clients, the value of the insurance is not well understood by themselves. Because as you said, the EQ, the Turkey is also the good value, because we tried too many times to educate risk transfer and risk, but actually the take up is another issue. And also there's a array of the options from the government side that exactly from the taxpayers' money. Maybe they think that insurance spent today, but it's kind of a promise, and the value only see when event happens. But they rather spend their money on the immediate emergency fund right now. So it really depends on the what is the prioritize of the public sector side. And also the other key challenge we see is that the public sector is very broad, because today we are talking about more sub and sovereign government side, but actually public sector including like state-owned enterprises like SBKC, or even in the development banks or other pools we talk a lot about this morning. So they have really very different motivations and purposes. Even Scott mentioned that even involving the stage of the development, each state have a different motivation and purposes. And for example, like sometimes like they need to managing the capacity, kind of insurance to ensuring underlying asset or portfolio. So they want to seek for better price, or sometimes they just want to have more high level fiscal position, hedging physical position. And also sometimes they are seeking a more familiarity of the product itself, because maybe we are much more overwhelmed by the new technology, maybe we are prone to the what instrument we are familiar with. So there's really background going on, different motivation there is. And also the other points I would mention is demand side from the public sector is one of the challenges we see. So the complexity of the public sector is bit different from the private sectors. And also the rigorous decision making process, and definitely the budgetary issues is another big issue. And even the decision making, each of the process, there's like many fold of the decision making needs to take into. And also the instability of the staff or civil servants sometimes, and also instability of the continuation of the risk transfer itself, also another key challenges we see. And maybe if I may add one more thing, that also there's like risk modeling perspective. Yes, there's a lot of sophisticated and state-of-the-art of risk model is available in certain part of the world, but many part of the world is still lack of those risk models. So that's also another challenges we see.
Yeah, particularly in not so developed, I guess, insurance markets, where maybe some of that attention from the big model vendors are not quite in these parts of the world,
yes,
like Africa and others. There are many challenges, so we'll get to maybe some of the solutions later. But on that point, pinging back to you, Michael, developing APAC versus LATAM, why do we see, you know, on a relative basis, far more take-up in the Latin American countries? You know, they're also developing countries versus APAC. You know, we see all these Chile bonds, very big ones. They even issued here in APAC, in Hong Kong. But, you know, why are we not seeing that? And like, you know, going back to Kikuchi-san's presentation, 5%, right, from 15.
Yeah, I mean, I think to echo some of the things Esther was saying, I think it's important to understand how difficult it can be in the public sector to buy insurance. That buying something, spending public money, and potentially getting nothing back for it, even though the nothing back scenario should be a great scenario.
I mean,
no big event occurred.
Two thumbs up
for
that.
It can be scary, and it can be personally, people can be in some of these countries personally liable for making those sort of decisions, and can be even more at danger, at risk, if they bought something, say, covering earthquake, a large earthquake occurred, but not quite large enough to trigger the insurance, then you can really talk about risk. And you can talk about people going to jail in some countries. Hopefully, Scott is not at that level of risk. But in some countries, people can go to jail for these sorts of decisions. So I would not underestimate the difficulty, personal difficulty of doing these sorts of things. And there's also political difficulties. We heard in one country we were working, which I never even thought of this issue before, but that the local politicians actually don't want insurance in place because they get a lot of value when an event happens, saying that they delivered aid, that they went to parliament and got aid for their region. And they want to take a truck to their region and hand out supplies themselves, as opposed to saying that the government has insured this and the government insurance is kicking in. So a lot of issues stop that. So why do we see, I think, LATAM leading? It's partly the security in numbers issue, quite frankly. It's the fact that if you can point to your neighbor doing it, it's a great justification. And that's, frankly, why we brought the Pacific Alliance countries, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru, together, because there is a great safety in that. And also, as Mexico being in this area one of the leaders in terms of sovereign risk transfer, having other countries being able to be closely aligned with Mexico, I think, is really the reason. It's clearly not to do with investor demand. I couldn't possibly say any of these trades we bring will be diversifiers, but I don't think the investors in the room would say they much prefer a Latin American diversifier over an Asian diversifier. I don't think that would be the case. I don't think it's a demand issue, certainly. And there's certainly not a risk issue, since if you talk risk, I'm sure Artemis has the deal information about, or the information about how much risk is in Asia, but I'm sure it's more than 50% of the natural disaster risk in the world must be in Asia. So it's not a risk issue. I think it really is a political issue, and it's once your neighbors start doing it, it becomes more likely for you to do it.
Thanks for sharing that, Michael. Really good learnings there, and good observations. And hopefully there'll be more friendly competition in the APAC area as well to make that more successful here. Pivoting to lessons learned and deals in focus, right? Just taking it a bit more granular at this point. Do we have any examples of lessons learned, both successes and failures, so to speak, or learnings from previous risk transfer schemes? For example, how do we guard against moral hazard in pooling mechanisms, subsidizing those at highest risk? Do we have any specific examples? Do you have any specific examples that you could share? Maybe I'll point this at Esther first.
Yes, maybe I will say that some lessons learned first, because actually when I say about the challenge in the previous question, the demand is lessons learned actually. Because many people think that, whether this model is work or, because I'm much more representative of a technical perspective here, but I would rather say that many times the technical issue is not our main bottleneck. The most part is the demand, as I mentioned. And also, the lessons learned, maybe I would say, because we talk about many of the pools here, but there's also like good example in the pool. But also, sometimes that collective failure is also another good lesson learned. The collective failures mean is kind of collective action challenges itself. For example, like adding multiple nations, adding multiple perils, that's increasing much more complexity. So we learn simplicity is rather important and is better because focusing on more one single peril or one single nations. So for example, actually I think that success and failures go together. For as mentioned, that Mexico is a really good example for us because they starting from the buying parametric from like pool starting about 17 years ago, but starting as earthquake first, a really simple get in the box parametric trigger. But evolves the time, now they are doing much more sophisticated structure, getting the grid structure, and even adding hurricane as well. And they even considering the different effect of wind, whether the wind is coming from the Caribbean side or whether it is a Pacific side. So actually the time grows, their institutional knowledge is growing, and their learning curve is sloped up, go right. So, and also it goes the same for the Jamaica case that Michael mentioned in the last year in the cap fund. They also start with the parametric purchase from the CRIF, And then they learning themselves, and they built on their own Capcom last year. So it takes some time learning curves, and they know what their risk is. So this is this important. But the collective challenges sometimes as like when adding, if you think that adding multiple perils or multiple and you not one single deals will be really simple, and maybe we will construct a really simple aggregated index that sounds really fabulous, but it also creates another fold of risk and spectrums. So we say we're encouraging pool because we do believe the benefit of the pool is that it's kind of, how do I say, friendly peer pressure each other, and also it increases increase preparedness before the prior events happens, and also it, in the midst of the process, they can learn of the whole risk analysis and the step of the decision process or decision-making process itself. But at the end, based on the pool, they need to learn themselves and go into the typical accustomed to their needs for the country itself. So
yeah. Wow.
I think that's the lesson learned and also success and failure at the same time.
Wow. So as you can see, it gets quite detailed very quickly. The nuance, devil was in the detail, right? And on that note, pivoting back to you again, Michael, and also in light of what our liquidity ILS brokers kindly shared earlier today about, I think, learning a new term, dead cat, right, of that Mexico deal that you're referring to, perhaps. Michael, do you want to share some of your thinking around that trigger mechanism, best tracks? Yeah, you know, we were sharing that last night, and I think it'll be great for the audience to sort of learn a little bit more about the nuances of these reporting and the trigger mechanisms and what sort of effects they can have on the investment communities and risk attitudes.
Yeah, I mean, among our clients, certainly Mexico has been in the market the longest, and as Esther was saying, you can see the development and the refinement of their, it's always been parametric, but they've been refining their parametric from very simple boxes to more granular grid patterns, all with the intention of trying to reduce as much as possible the huge risk that can't be eliminated, which is basis risk. And because they've been in the market a while, we now have experiences, and Mexico's had, including at least one negative experience with basis risk. In one of the Mexican transactions, which was Multicat, 2012, there was a very strong hurricane that hit Mexico called Hurricane Odile. And Mexico was using National Hurricane Center data in what they called the best track report, was the definitive report for the payout, the best track report being what's produced usually after the hurricane season. So it could be, depending on when the event occurs, it could be many months later, but it was considered the most reliable National Hurricane Center report. So the trigger was based on best track data. Initial reports, initial National Hurricane Center data all suggested there would be a payout. So I'm sure the Tulip Prebone folks were quite busy with that because it was all suggested that there should be a payout. Now we were waiting, of course, for the best track information to come out. And when the best track report came out, it showed barely a miss. And one of the main factors, or let's say the factor for why it was a miss, was because the National Hurricane Center used data provided by a storm chaser, a guy named Josh Morgeman, who, I don't know if he's here. If Josh is here, it'd be great if he would come up. But he's basically a professional storm chaser, quite a dashing-looking fellow. And he goes, when he hears there's a storm about to hit, he goes there. So he went down, this is a storm that hit Cabo San Lucas. So he went down, he checked himself into a cheap motel in Cabo San Lucas, and he put on his equipment, and he went out into the storm when it hit, and he took readings of central pressure. And God knows if how well he calibrated his equipment was, but he put on his website what these readings were, and the National Hurricane Center referenced those readings by Josh Morgerman, storm chaser, as a reason why they reduced the increased the central pressure, making the near miss. So that obviously, you can imagine the Mexican government reading that, and had they had no idea, and we had no idea that the National Hurricane Center in the United States would be using storm chaser data. But the National Hurricane Center, of course, is not beholden to the ILS market. They're much more like a scientific body, and they say, we're going to use any data we see. So that also made the Mexican government very sensitive to the issue of basis risk and even more focused on refining and trying to reduce that basis risk as much as possible. And we have not, fortunately, had another miss like that, and we have not had another run-in with Josh Morgenman. I can tell you at the World Bank, there were people speculating to me that Josh Morgenman had been hired by ILS firms to go to Mexico and give false readings. And although I'm sure that's absurd, I had no proof that that wasn't the case, even though I know that's a crazy theory.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing that a government faces in this market, and why they're there. Although they still haven't eliminated that risk, we've tried with the Mexican government, and I think all the modeling has been done by AAR for the Mexican case, with AAR to try to reduce the basis risk down as much as possible by being much more granular.
Thanks for sharing that, Michael. That's fascinating. And just for the record, we're not, anti-parametric. We don't have an anti-parametric agenda, but just to put it out there.
Or anti-storm chaser.
or against storm chasers. Okay, moving on. Time's passing very quickly. The EQC, finally we get again to Totara Reef, seeking $225 million, which still pales in comparison to the $7.2 billion or traditional reinsurance tower that you purchase, right? Wanted to cover something that was already covered earlier today, so we'll just skip that and go to the reception of the ILS community to the bond. And also, were there any challenges in extending it from maybe, say, a pure earthquake to a multi-peril, or at least it was communicated as a multi-peril transaction, particularly after the recent Auckland floods and Cyclone Gabrielle? Scott, do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, from our perspective, we got a great hearing from the ILS market, and some great engagements. We undertook a roadshow trip through Europe and into North America for a week, and met with probably 30 or 40 different investors, and got a great hearing. So we were really, really excited by that. And as I said earlier, For those that participated, that's fantastic. But actually, for those that actually really took the deal seriously and devoted serious time before saying no to this one, we're really, really thankful for the time and effort that they put into it. I guess one of the challenges for us as we brought this deal to market, and it was very much a conversation with the structuring and joint book runners as well, was that our act covers a block of peril. So that's what our act does, and our board was very clear that it didn't want to be going out to market without all of those perils being covered. So, there was quite a lot of work, obviously, that went into describing from our perspective the types of experiences that we'd had with volcano and tsunami and hydrothermal events, which is, geysers coming up in your backyard. So we'd had one of those, which we were able to point to. And but these are not things that we'd actually had significant experience with for over 150 years. So people took it as an earthquake bond and really approached it in that sense. But fingers crossed. Time will tell. We won't have too much activity over the course of the next 3 or 4 years on any of those perils. Because to Michael's point, we put in place this cover, and actually, whilst it, from an insurance perspective, it might feel like a grudge payment, actually you really don't want the payout, because it does mean that there's been in our case, a $2 billion loss, which, to put that in context, the Kaikoura earthquake that we had in 2016, which was exactly the same magnitude, depth, and fault rupture of the Turkish earthquake, that was a $700 million deal for us. That was a $700 million loss for us. It wouldn't touch our reinsurance. So you know, when you start to talk about that size and scale of earthquake to get to $2 billion of New Zealand loss, you know, it's a big event that you actually don't want, and given I live in Wellington, chance it might happen to my house.
No, I think you make some great points there, Scott, and also back to that Turkey earthquake, really that $100 billion shouldn't happen. It should not be anywhere near that. You know, risk transfer is really for the residual risk, and you know, to bring that down, you know, you made comparisons to the Kaikoura earthquake, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And again, you know, we think of risk transfer very much as part of a fully integrated risk management framework. You know, people in this room will understand this. You know, you want to avoid the worst risks, and you do that through your land planning. And you know, you don't put houses in swamps or on liquefaction prone soil. Sadly, you know, there's probably 20% of the houses in New Zealand that are in exactly that situation. But then you're investing. We invest a lot of money and time and effort in science to influence building codes. So you're looking to control against those risks. The transfer piece is how do you package up the residual risk, mm-hmm. and then ultimately you've got to accept it. So that kind of active framework is actually really important. And I guess we sit in the transfer space a lot, but a lot of the work we're trying to do as a government agency, working with other government agencies through funding of research, through just generally kind of advocating with other government agencies, is trying to influence that kind of the whole gamut of that.
And it's fantastic to see that cross sort of nation collaboration, if you like, with other regulators, with other governments as well. No, it's fantastic. Thanks, Scott. I mean,
it helps you live in a country that's smaller in population size than Singapore and most cities in Australia. So, you know, we do feel like a little bit of a village.
So with the recent withdrawal of private insurers in key markets, for example, California wildfire and Florida windstorm, how can the public sector be deployed to ensure sustainable and affordable? I noticed that hasn't really been coming up today, affordable insurance capacity. So I'll ping that to Michael.
That one's for me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or I could... While you're holding that thought, I could maybe get you again, Scott, to reflect on that.
One thing which, again, New Zealand government has a key desire to make natural hazard cover available and affordable for all New Zealanders. As I said earlier, we do a little bit of that through the making it really hard not to have natural hazard insurance because it automatically attaches to a fire policy. But the affordable piece, the government effectively cross-subsidises across the country. We, you know, it's a country that sits astride two tectonic plates, the Pacific and the Australian. You know, the risk, nowhere in New Zealand is immune from risk, so everybody in New Zealand pays the same flat rate for EQC cover and has done since the scheme came. So there's an inbuilt cross-subsidisation for those that live in higher risk sort of earthquake zones, but you know, various other parts of the country are potentially more subject to tsunami or to mm-hmm. volcanics. So the government has made policy choices to make natural hazard insurance affordable by effectively making it a flat rate from Kaitaia to the Bluff.
Thanks for that. And Michael, do you have any opinions on that?
Well, I mean, what we're doing in this market is really quite a bit different from Scott. We're really helping governments generally ensure their fiscal positions. Usually our end beneficiary of the insurance is a Ministry of Finance. Not as directly down to the individual level, but certainly cost is a significant issue, but so is capacity. And so we always... when we're looking at the cap bond market, we're often bringing very large size transactions. The transaction we did for Chile most recently is a $630 million transaction. We're bringing very large transactions. So we very much welcome liquid markets, and we very much recognize that highly liquid cap bond markets generally correspond to times when pricing is a little bit higher because the cap bond investor communities are obviously much better able to attract capital when prices are a bit higher. So We understand, I think, and accept that sort of trade-off between capacity and cost. We always want the best of both worlds, but we live in a market environment where we understand that trade-off.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, on to, I think, the closing stages of this panel. A lot has been said about climate change, the sort of the broad reaction, especially from those that are not within the practitioner fraternity, tend to sort of be very cautious about climate change when it comes to investing in these perils and natural catastrophe risks, for example. So, assuming there is, in fact, an increase in the frequency and intensity of some of these perils in certain areas, can something like resilience bonds be deployed? So just to clarify, the resilience bonds, everyone refers to them meaning different things, but for this panel, we're talking about bonds, essentially catastrophe bonds that have a dual component of risk transfer and risk adaptation or resilience infrastructure investment. So given that that's not strictly a new concept, why hasn't it gotten much traction so far? So that one's for you, Esther.
Yes, thank you, Alex. As you mentioned, that resilience bond, actually we need to understand what we are exactly talking about, because sometimes resilience bond, as you said, that just a typical bond, just bond instrument, that instrument, just a principle can be invested into the resilience or adaptation kind of projects. And kind of thematic bond, so actually there's no risk transfer components in here. So just labeling it, it's a green or ESG, blue, resilience, just name it. It can be resilience bond. Or in other type, as you said about the rebate component, is that there is also a performance-linked bond, which is once a activity or a project is performed or completed, then pre-agreed discount of coupon is activated. So actually, this is also one part of the bond, and there is no exact risk transfer components there is. So these two, the typical thematic bond and also this performance linked bond, they are not cap bond. But when we're talking about like cap bond, or just not aside to that resilience, but cap bonds, definitely the risk transfer component is the key. And also the principle itself, the usage of principle is almost impossible. So the principle actually invested by the investors, it should be locked in, collateralized in the account, which is also goes to the money market funds, but they cannot be used in any other purpose. They are locked in for the future events, for the future triggering events, for the prompt liquidity. But when we're talking about, is there anything kind of the mixture of performance-linked bond and also the cap bond, then we can just simply thinking about it's just a 1 + 1 = 2, which means as a sponsor's point of view, they have to pay 2, which is they are buying 2 bonds. This 1 + 1 is not 1.5. So as a sponsor's point of view, I don't think it's also attractive in that they have to cost it on that.
So it's more, perhaps it's more effective in theory only, but when it actually comes to the practicalities of looking at how much resilience a project that maybe, infrastructure project, like a flood levy or something, takes about 10 years to build, but cat bond, typically 3 years. So how do you, there's mismatch of timelines and everything else. But no, that was great. So I think we had time, but maybe if we're running a bit ahead, Steve, could open for a couple of questions from the audience, if there's no objection from the panelists.
No.
Any questions? If not, I've got quite a few, actually.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Good. My name is Sarn. I'm from JP Morgan. My question is predominantly to Mike. Mike, you've been at it for...
I can hear you, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Speak louder. So, Mike, you've been at it for a better part of 2 decades, and you say 189 member companies, but of course you are will not be addressing all of them, since many of them are, of course, high-income countries already. So you'll be focusing on the most vulnerable countries. So how big is the pie for you? I mean, if you could do them all, and if you could basically address as many perils as possible, how big could this potentially be for World Bank, you think? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we have unfortunate position that we have a lot of very vulnerable countries that are part of our shareholders. So amount of risk we could be transferring is quite high. We have ultimately our value proposition in this market, however, tends to be that we're offering diversifying risk to the market. So and that provides a great pricing benefit, the fact that we're offering diversifiers that allows ILS investors to load up more on peak perils because they buy one of our deals and it diversifies. That pricing benefit comes from being a diversifier. So if we're issuing $20 billion of bonds into the market each year, suddenly World Bank trades become the peak peril. And I think there's some market limitations to how much the market could absorb. We always have looked at sort of a number of about $5 billion a year as kind of would be a great number to reach. If we could do $5 billion of transactions a year of different kinds for all of our members, we think in terms of the current market and our own internal capacity to do trades and our own funding volumes, that would probably be a really good number. But we're not there yet.
Thank you. I'm actually new to this cat bonds and actually catastrophe reinsurance markets. So I want to get your thoughts or estimates regarding what the potential for APAC, just in terms of where would the investors potentially actually could come from. This is not something that I think has been well marketed. A lot of the high net worth individuals or family offices has naturally not been complete access into this market, like stocks, funds, or PE, private credit. So what do you see the gap here and how we can fit it?
Who's got that one, me? I mean, personally, what I think is that there's a big investor education need here. And some of that education will not necessarily lead to institutional investors here setting up a cat bond team and starting buying cat bonds, but it could lead to them allocating more or allocating for the first time to an ILS fund. And from our perspective at the World Bank, either one works because we want more capacity for cat bonds. So whether a big Singapore institutional investor sets up his own cat bond team or allocates to an existing cat bond fund, and there's many represented in the room, so you could find them. Either one is a win in our mind. But there should be, just because of all the reasons we've heard today, there should be more Asian investors in this market, and we certainly hope it happens, whether directly or through funds.
Do you think there's a perception of disaster, catastrophe? Like when you talk to a layperson, that's not exactly very appealing. And also when Michael Lewis refers to this industry as the nature's casino, maybe potentially defeats the social, giving aspect of what we do.
Many people at the World Bank tell me that. I mean, I always think life insurance is the greatest marketing name ever because you're insuring death. But you call it life insurance, and I don't know what the other side of catastrophe is, but if there is that version, I think that would be very, very helpful, because I don't think death insurance would play as well.
All right. Any other questions? If not, please join me in thanking the panelists today.